Welcome to Best Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM, this February 9th, 2016 edition, episode 76, or my grandmother's 101st birthday, God rest her soul, of Nature Best Last comes to you live from the Mud Hut in southern New Mexico. Our thanks to Afrizin for his theme song contribution. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. In a minute, we'll be joined by our guest today, Leighton Woodhouse, who is calling in from Southern California. And we're also taking calls this week, so if you have any questions for our guest or for us, please give us a toll-free call at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. First, though, as often is the case, Guy has something to say.
Don't sound so enthusiastic about it. And you failed to mention our live studio audience, which is comprised of two, not counting us.
Yay!
So there you go. They're an enthusiastic two.
Enthusiastics.
Well, I'm annoyed.
Oh, shocking.
Yeah, I know. When I'm annoyed, I'm inclined to tell everybody about it, whether they appreciate it or not. In this case, I'm annoyed with Extinction Radio.
Our friends at Extinction.
Yes, our friends at Extinction. Sometimes friends annoy me.
I don't.
Case in point, well, I wasn't going to say your name, but since you brought it up.
We're not friends.
Apparently, they've become agnostic about Extinction. Here's what one of the hosts says in an interview with Dmitry Orlov. The host apparently is pandering to Orlov with a question, nodding to his presumed perception of Orlov's view about Extinction.
Extinction Radio, remember before we were on air, I read your mission statement. So there's people, it's a very wide spectrum of people who believe that we're all going to be dead in 15 years, to people who believe in technological fixes. And we're basically agnostic as to each of those scenarios.
So there you go. Extinction Radio is agnostic about extinction. Orlov responds on his blog, cluborlov.com, quote, I discuss collapse, weird old America, and all the reasons why near-term human extinction is something of a faulty intellectual product, end quote.
Oh.
Yeah. Turns out the host at Extinction Radio was right. Orlov dismisses the notion of near-term human extinction as, quote, a faulty intellectual product, as if extinction is a product for sale at the right price. Even Extinction Radio has turned agnostic about extinction, thus belying their name. Apparently, Homo sapiens sapiens, the self-proclaimed, doubly proclaimed wise ape, is wiser than the dozen or so other species of apes that have already gone extinct. And by apes, I mean humans.
Oh,
other species of humans that have gone extinct.
Oh, other species of
humans. A dozen before us.
Before us, correct. Yes.
But we're wiser than them because we got to name ourselves.
Right.
To his credit, the host of the show said he'd be providing clarification on this week's show, and he personally believes humans will be extinct soon. How soon remains unknown, which is what I say, too. The cultural pressure is profound, as I know better than most, but once you've chosen to swim upstream, hence earned the disparagement of everybody you know, you may as well keep going. Or to put a Churchillian spin on it, if you're going through hell, keep going.
All right.
Yeah, that's a nice start.
That's a good start.
You know, I had like two friends left in the world. And now we're down to one.
Oh, I'm sure, you know, everybody can take criticism. Except me. Except me, of course.
Why would anybody criticize you?
I don't know.
You're a privileged white male.
That's right. Stop talking. All right. Our guest is Leighton Akil Woodhouse. He is a journalist, filmmaker, and graphic designer in Los Angeles, armed with a master's degree in sociology from the University of California in Berkeley. His print stories have appeared in Gawker, The New Republic, Vice News, The Nation, Salon, and The All. He had produced short documentaries for The Nation, Story of Stuff, and Participant Media. He has a master's degree in sociology, again, from UC Berkeley. You can read all about his work at LeightonWoodhouse.com. Thank you for joining us on the Progressive Radio Network and Nature Bats Last, Leighton Woodhouse.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good.
Excellent. Why don't we start a little bit with your personal history and how you wound up with a master's in sociology, and how did your educational experience lead to your work as a journalist and a filmmaker?
I guess it was kind of a long, convoluted experience. I actually started off my work life in the labor movement as an organizer. That was 15 years ago or so. I did that for a while. I decided to go to graduate school because why not? That's what people do when they're young. And so I did that, and I was going to be a college professor, decided against that after getting my master's degree, mostly because I got distracted by the 2004 election, which I was ran a federal political action committee during that election. That got me out of Ivory Tower and back into the real world. And from there, I went back into the labor movement. And then from there, went on to do a company called Brave New Films, which does issue advocacy documentaries. So that was sort of when I started to put my toe in the water of filmmaking. I was not a producer there. I was their communications director and then their political director, running campaigns around issues, legislative issues, et cetera. And from there, I then went on to become a freelance. I partnered up with a producer from Brave New Films. We started the company and doing freelance video production, and so that's how I that's the roundabout way of how I eventually became a freelance journalist and filmmaker.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's really, that's amazing.
Well, the good news is you avoided being a professor, which you can attest to.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
But union organizer, sort of community organizer, politically oriented, I guess that feeds into the films that you're making right now. Mm-hmm. So on your website, LeightonWoodhouse.com, there are several short, hard-hitting films.
Right.
And by short, I mean less than 5 minutes long. And it seems to me that's the contemporary approach used to capture the attention of an audience with very short attention spans. And even feature-length films move very quickly from one scene to the next. And I get why this is necessary, considering the audience, but I also see it as something of a self-reinforcing feedback loop. In appealing to an audience with a short attention span, the films become shorter and tend to favor high production values and entertainment as much or more than serious content. So, Where do we draw the line? Do you see what I'm getting at here? That the short film appeals to people and it becomes shorter and shorter and more appealing, and pretty soon we're a Twitter nation. What are your thoughts about that trend?
Well, I mean, like any filmmaker, I would love to be working on a feature film or a feature documentary in my case. Nothing would make me happier. That's obviously a much heavier lift in terms of raising a budget, having a story to tell that can fill that amount of time, the story that you can shoot a 60 or 90 minute feature out of would need to be quite compelling to be able to command that kind of attention span. But the reality is, we live in a world in which people are consuming their media on the internet. If you have a video longer than a commercial break, it's probably not going to get a lot of eyeballs. It's much less expensive, obviously, to produce a shorter video like that, so that makes it more realistic from a production standpoint. It also is consumable, what they call in the industry snackable content. I agree that it diminishes attention spans. If I could have everybody sitting down watching a 2-hour feature documentary on economic inequality or climate change, then that would be terrific. And that happens every once in a while. But you know, I do think that as if people are spending their time online watching short videos or reading short blog posts, I would rather those blog posts, those videos, those articles be about important issues, you know, put those issues on people's radars rather than watching, you know, a BuzzFeed video, as much as I love BuzzFeed videos. So I think that's sort of the world that we operate in. You've got to go to where the audience is. The audience is online, and that's the format of the internet.
Yeah, I mean, you cover some pretty heavy stuff in your writing and in your films. And what has been the response? I mean, these are not easy things to necessarily watch or read.
Yeah.
You know, I read your Vice piece about the LAPD, and, you know, obviously you're talking about methane leaks in your films, and you're talking about climate change and the climate conference. What has been the response?
I mean, it's varied. Different responses to different videos and articles. You know, sometimes you don't always. As a content producer and creator, you don't always get to hear a whole lot of feedback about what you produce, other than the people who chime in on comment threads online, which is, you know, oftentimes a non-representative sample.
Right.
So I wish I had better analytics to share with you, but I would say that with the short format for making, I mean, it's just like with a written article. If you have a space of 3,000 words to write a really in-depth magazine-length piece, obviously you have much more space to be able to explore the depths of a subject, to be able to go into a lot of the nuance of it. If you're only given 350 words, you really have to get to the point. And it's the same thing with videos that I've found, that with a short format, while yes, it's fleeting, it's a shorter attention span format, it also forces you to really zero in on what the issue is and find the thing that's going to resonate most with people emotionally and intellectually, and really get to the point and distill it down to its essence, which I think is actually helpful for conveying a message or at least getting an issue on somebody's radar.
Okay, so when you're picking your subject areas, are these things that motivate you personally, or are these things that you think will drive an audience?
It depends. Right now I'm working with Participant Media. And so we have, you know, we have a newsroom here, and so I come up with pitches for videos that I would like to produce, and that is driven by my values and my interests. And luckily, I'm fortunate enough to work for a place where that is driven by a mission. You know, it's not just a profit; it's a for-profit company, but it's got a double bottom line, which is that they are in pursuit of a mission. Really, the mission comes before any sort of worry about the financial bottom line. So there's some nice affinity there. But I have to get it through, you know, other folks, on our team to approve it. And that's how the process goes for the films that I've been doing over the last few months. Prior to that, I was doing freelance production. And in those cases, you know, sometimes I would just do issues that I cared about that, and I would just do it off the sweat of my own labor and sometimes pay for some of the budget out of pocket. Obviously, that's not sustainable. But I did it from time to time because I cared about an issue. But more often I would, you know, get commissioned by a client to produce a video back when I was freelancing, whether that client was an issue advocacy organization or a magazine like The Nation, for example. And so in those cases, oftentimes, sometimes it would come from me, sometimes it would come from them. But always it was, you know, I really only do content about issues that I think matter and are important and that accord with my values. It's not often that I do anything that's just commercially oriented or, you know, is issue agnostic.
Right.
So maybe Mark Twain was ahead of his time on the whole Twitter thing. You remember his line, "I didn't have time to write a short letter, so I wrote a long one instead." And you bring up a good point, Leighton, that boiling something down to a few minutes and making it attractive and appealing and capturing the message in a short period of time, that's tough. You know,
yeah.
Mike and I have been involved in a film that needed some serious editing, probably could have been cut in half and it would have gotten the message across equally well. So,
yeah, I mean, you're a writer, so you know that it's easier if an editor says you have as much space as you want to write this piece, that is a much easier assignment than if they say you have this space limitation, or Worse yet, you turn in something that's 1,500 words long and they say cut it in half. It's a good exercise, but it's much easier if you're a writer, just like if you're a film producer, to go long than to work within those constraints.
Well, right, and after you put a word on paper, and I assume after you put an image on film, it becomes part of you, and you can't bear to let it go.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. I mean, it's really hard to cut that stuff. I wrote that word.
Yeah. Until you show it to someone else, and they go, yeah, that's so long.
Exactly. That's why we don't show other people. So along your path, were there any of the proverbial big breaks along the way? Can you tell us about those, if they happened?
Big breaks, that is a good question. You know, not that I can think of. I think it's been more like a steady hustle. I mean, freelancing is always a hustle. And when you get, I mean, there was a piece I wrote for Gawker, which was a long form story about community policing within the Los Angeles Police Department. And the fact that that was published by, you know, a publication that I respect and that gives space for long form journalism and has a huge audience. You know, I personally, I can't say that it was a huge break professionally for me, but I can say that I felt very good about being about having that story published and having a story and having that story published in that publication. So there were breaks like that along the way, but for the most part, you know, it is hard to be a freelance creative nowadays because there is less and less. I mean, these videos, if you produce a video and put it online, and somebody tries to sell ads off it, chances are they're not even going to net the production costs that they put into it. The economics of it just do not work out, which means that the returns to content producers and creators, including writers, is less and less, and it is very, very, very challenging to cobble together a living out of it, which, by the way, is, I think, much more dangerous than the attention span issue, because what that means is that you are forced to, if you're a writer, for example, doing the kind of copywriting, or if you're a video producer, just doing the kind of, producing the kind of garbage that you need to produce to be able to get even a small paycheck. And that is a race to the bottom.
Right. A while back, you mentioned working with members of your organization to create a story. And we don't know how that works. Can you take us through that a little bit? Take us inside the organization. How many people are we talking about? What are the meetings amount to? How does that whole process work? Or is it just boring as hell?
Well, Participant, the company I'm currently employed by, is a unique company. It's a film company. It's the producer of An Inconvenient Truth. That was a long time ago, but more recently, Spotlight, which is up for Best Picture nomination. A Look of Silence, which is up for Best Documentary nomination. So it's a lot of feature films about issues that matter dearly to a lot of people. Siriano is another one. Good Night and Good Luck. So that's the film side. And then there is a cable channel called Pivot. And then there is a digital side called Take Part. And Take Part is the team that I'm a part of. I don't know how many reporters there are, probably about 20 or so. And my, you know, I have a lot of creative freedom, which is a blessing. And so I come up with a pitch. It's got to be, you know, sort of on mission for Participant. But that's a broad portfolio. It can be about civil liberties. It can be about human rights. It can be about the environment. Obviously, climate change is a huge issue for this company, being that it's the one company that produced an Inconvenient Truth. You know, the hardest part is not getting it through any sort of committee, but just finding an interesting story to tell, going out there in the world and reporting, and finding stories that are not hackneyed and that lend some insight into something important. And those stories don't come along very often, and you really have to scour for them. So the process is find the story, pitch it, gets greenlit, and then drop an outline or a treatment, do a little bit of pre-reporting groundwork, put together the production, which means, you know, hiring a crew if you need to, shooting myself if I need to, location scouting, et cetera, and then shooting it, and then getting into the editing room and spending a few days cutting the piece together. And that whole process can take anywhere from, I've done that whole process in 4 days before, I've also done videos that have taken months to get through.
So what are the odds of a pitch going through about a movie on near-term human extinction? Probably little to none, huh?
I actually
people
have
leaving
that
the room.
Work. no, that's a issue I am interested in, and I do hope to be able to secure a budget to produce a video on it. So hopefully that'll come into fruition someday soon.
Yeah, I mean, Guy and I, you know, that's obviously what we talk about. So we can send you what the facial expression may look like if. if you put it in front of the right people.
Yeah. Scary stuff.
Well, that leads into the next question. What projects are you currently working on? Besides that one, obviously.
I just finished one on the, there's this gas leak here, which is, I think people are familiar with by now because it's been reported on, but it's probably still vastly underreported compared to its environmental footprint and its public right. health footprint, which is this gas leak in Porter Ranch.
Yeah.
So I just finished that video, and that's up right now. And
yeah,
I'm
that was
looking
excellent,
into
by
a
the
few
way.
Other... Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, I'm looking into a few other stories right now. There's a story about unaccompanied minors from Central America, refugees, which is a subject that I've covered in both in print and video extensively in the past. So there's a story that I'm hoping to be able to tell about that. There's another one that I'm looking into about sexual assault in prisons, which is also a subject I've actually covered before. My wife works for a nonprofit that works on that issue. So there's a story I'm looking into there. There's another piece on the Zika virus that's one we are doing. I'm in pre-production on it. And then I'm always just looking for more stories.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like there's any shortage of stories going on.
Yeah, no
well,
kidding.
Well, no, there's a shortage of good stories.
Yeah, right, there you go.
Yeah.
We interviewed a journalist about the Porter Ranch leak. Was that
two weeks ago.
2 weeks ago,
yeah.
2 weeks ago, I guess. And I just saw, come across the headlines today, the Zika virus is the CDC's, the CDC has declared a level one disaster. That's only the fourth time in history they've declared a level one disaster.
Yeah.
So this is a big deal, and I would call the Zika virus mosquitoes on climate change.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really, yeah. I mean, suddenly that and dengue and malaria, they're spreading all over the place.
Right.
Wonder why, I was teaching about that more than 15 years ago.
Yeah.
That would be one of the consequences.
Yeah, I came across a stat that said dengue, the inhabitable area for the virus, which is, the inhabitable area for the mosquitoes that carry the virus is now, I think it said it tripled the size that it was 30 years ago or so, and that's because of climate change.
Right. Yeah, and that's what we try and do on this show. We try and connect, different issues with climate change so people can see how it, impacts their lives and in different ways. And I think you're doing that actually with your films. Obviously, the Porter Ranch film is where, we need natural gas because, this is how this culture works and this is how what it runs on. And there are consequences for that, and people don't necessarily see the consequences. They don't necessarily see them in what I would call affluent neighborhoods,
which is a
unique case. So.
Right.
Yeah, and the story, which I've seen some reporting on it, which is hopeful, but the connection between climate change and geopolitical conflict is a hugely important story to tell, especially nowadays. I mean, you can't. As with all world events, you can't distill them all into one single cause, but there's certainly a huge climate change component to the Syrian civil war around the drought in Syria and the refugee crisis, and ultimately to some of the terrorist attacks that we've seen in Paris and here in our backyard in LA and San Bernardino County, where distant cousins of a precipitating cause of climate change and the recurrent droughts in the Middle East that have been caused by them that have driven up food prices and caused the Arab Spring, et cetera. That stuff is touching all of us.
I mean, your film about the protesting going on in Paris. What are some of your feelings about the general public, or, you know, it seems to me that there's a at least a somewhat of a shift of there's less apathy out there, and there's a bigger sense of urgency, at least at this particular climate talk, because it seemed like people were put on alert a little more. This was almost, if we don't do something now, well, then we're never going to do something. What were your feelings about the protest and the film you made?
Well, you know, that protest was supposed to be much, much bigger than it ended up being. And the reason why it ended up being much smaller is not because of apathy, but because of the terrorist attacks in Paris.
Right.
Paris at the time was under a state of emergency. So it was actually illegal for a time. They ended up backing away from this before the protest began. But for a while, the state of emergency rules were such that it was illegal to gather in groups of more than two on the streets of Paris. So this is against the backdrop of them trying to pull together the biggest mobilization around climate change in history, and obviously that changed everything. The fact that people were still out on the streets in by the thousands is quite telling. I mean, it shows the political resolve of those groups behind the demonstrations. I found it heartening to see that there were people who were willing to go out and, even in defiance of the state, to make their voices heard.
To me, people, maybe at least from what you just told me, that people are waiting, or not waiting as much for permission to do something.
Like to see more of that.
Yeah, there were going to be major civil disobediences as part of that demonstration as well. You know, massive acts of unlawful activity. You know, nonviolent unlawful activity. But given the political climate at the time, you know, it would be like doing that in Manhattan right after 9/11. It was not only unsafe to the protesters, but it would just seemed like the message would not hit in the way that you would want it to. So that didn't happen, but that political resolve is still there among those very people who are planning those demonstrations. And I'm sure that it will be, that it will happen in the near future.
Do you think, I mean, this is a personal question. Do you think there will come a time where we come to a point where we have decided that nonviolence is just not doing it, and we're literally being killed unless we react in a violent way towards the state? I mean, do you see that as something that could be a possibility down the road? Because, I mean, I'm all for peaceful protest, and I'm all for civil disobedience. But if you're getting your throat stepped on and you're literally dying, and it comes to that point, will civilization, you know, those of us growing up in it, will it come to a point where we just revolt?
I would say that, well, first of all, you know, as I was saying before, there are massive amounts of violence which are connected to climate change in an indirect way. So I'm not talking about people, you know, revolting over climate change, but the factors that climate change puts into place lead to situations of geopolitical conflict within and between nations. That's already happening, and it's on the rise. I don't know what a revolution would look like around climate change, because what are your targets? You know, as favorable as the government, as governments in the United States and elsewhere in the West are to polluters, it's not as if you take down the government and then all of a sudden the polluters aren't polluting anymore. These are private corporations that are causing this with government as the handmaiden. So I'm not really sure. It's such a complicated scenario that it's not like we have a dictatorship and we're going to take it over and have a coup. You know, it's too. I don't know what that configuration would look like. I do think that it would be, I mean, ultimately, I think that nonviolent protest is really the only effective way to be able to build a mass movement. I mean, you see what happened in with the Arab Spring in Egypt, where there was nonviolent protest, which is hugely effective for a time. And then at the time at which it degraded into violence, and this is not because anybody chose to, it was because they were being attacked by the state, and so there was a violent reaction. Same in Syria, right? Nonviolent protest came, and then until the point at which people who were resisting the state had no choice but to take up arms because they were being shot at and killed in the streets. And so I have absolute sympathy with those who just simply need to defend themselves. But right. What came out of that, the complete mayhem, you know, the Islamic State, a nightmare, hell on earth is, mm-hmm. is what Syria looks like today. So, you know, it is easier, much easier to advocate taking up arms and force than it is to control that beast once it's unleashed.
Yeah, it seems like that's the predicament we're in. You know, we do something peaceful until the state doesn't want to put up with it anymore, and then they attack, and then what do? Do we sit back and remain peaceful, or do we defend ourselves because we're being killed? And ultimately, if we're attacking something, a structure like, you know, the industrial structure, that's something that we are all highly dependent on. Don't know how to live any other way. It's not like I can go out and hunt and gather and, you know, start living my life without fossil fuels and food showing up to the stores. So it's the way I look at it is we're in a situation where we're stuck because the very thing we depend on is killing us.
Yeah. I mean, look, for either fortunately or unfortunately, we're nowhere near the point of even having to contemplate the decision as to tactically what kind of approaches we adopt in order to effect radical change, because we're not even at the point where there's a population that even believes in that climate change exists, that human-made climate change exists. But yeah. I mean, that's changing, but certainly not a population where that makes their top three priority issues. Right. And I don't know if it's ever going to come to a point where that consciousness is present in a dispersed enough way when it's not way too late for any of that political will to make a difference materially.
Yeah, I agree.
Right, absolutely. I'm reminded of a couple of things. One, a quote from Howard Zinn, civil disobedience is not our problem. Our problem is civil obedience. Mm-hmm. We just keep mm-hmm. going along with the whole show. And Mike and I typically see climate change as a symptom, as an outcome of this set of living arrangements, along with a whole bunch of other outcomes, like driving to extinction 150 species a day and spoiling the air and fouling the water and so on. And so you think we're going to have a significant number of people within this culture rise up against this culture? I don't see that happening.
Yeah,
no,
the alternative
I don't either.
Is a Vanguard movement.
Maybe that's a film.
You're listening to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. We're conversing today with journalist Leighton Woodhouse. Thank you again for joining us, Leighton. And I'm afraid I interrupted something you were about to say.
Oh, I was just going to say that the alternative, if you don't have if you don't have that kind of mass-based consciousness of a problem as acute as climate change, is a Vanguard-led movement. And, you know, I can't think of a single instance in history where a Vanguard-led revolutionary movement has ended with a happy ending.
Right. And, you know, in those revolutions, they end up, they just kind of revolve and they come back to where we seem where we started or we began. So,
yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, no revolution has succeeded. That's why we need another one, right?
Right.
We need to get serious about
it
this time. By gum.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that revolutions don't work. I'm saying that revolutions that are not mass based and that are Vanguard led, that is a recipe for disaster.
Right. Yeah. And any sort of revolution, it seems, based upon what we're talking about here. I don't, and I think you mentioned this. There's not a consciousness to actually change the living arrangement all that much. You know, we want to shuffle the cards a little bit, but when it comes down to it, we still want stuff showing up the way it does. We want all our goods and services imported to us, our basic human needs. But we just we want it to be a little more green and maybe with some alternative fuel and maybe less oppression. We have a caller. It's Chris from California. Chris, you there? You have a question?
Yeah, hi, I'm here. Hi. Yeah, I've been trying to call in. I just keep forgetting that every week that the show is on, I miss it. But I'm in Northern California, pretty close to where this middle town is, where there's that big fire in last September. Mm-hmm. And it burned out like most of this one town completely. And it got like 3 miles from where I am. And so I saw, the guy's like background where it said you're a firefighter, and especially with tree biology and all this stuff. One of the questions I had first for the guest was, I've had a cell phone since they first came out, a long time ago, and I got bored with them. But I remember like around 2005 when YouTube started, and I was looking at it, right in the beginning, but basically just like music videos. But now, I've seen like 10 years later, it's so huge. And I was wondering if the guest has like any inside information of like how much faster is this going to keep going? Because it's like I missed the Twitter thing, like when they put out the information kind of like on those Jon Stewart shows where you miss the directive where they, everyone's going to start Twittering now. But, and then there's Instagram. But how much farther is it going to go? Do you have any inside information on that? Because there's so much social media that it's hard to keep up with it.
I mean, I don't have any inside information, but clearly the trend lines are that video on the internet is the, I think now at this point, online video viewing is the most popular activity on the internet, which means that it dwarfs social media. So people spend more time with streaming video online than they do on Facebook and Twitter, et cetera. That's how big it's become. Of course, that includes things like Netflix and Roku and, when you sit down and watch a whole feature-length show. And by the way, as much as things are getting chopped down to now 15-second lengths, videos on Instagram can only be 15 seconds, and now we're seeing more 15-second videos being produced, which is, you can't get much shorter than that. But at the same time, attention spans are being also, I think, served in the opposite direction with some in-depth, much higher quality commercial productions on Netflix and on HBO, et cetera. So I think that the trends cut in both directions.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me there's more documentaries than there have ever been. I mean, when I was a kid, you basically had to watch PBS to see anything that was a documentary.
Yeah. Yeah.
You got PBS where you lived?
Yeah.
Wow.
I was rich.
So, final question, Leighton. We'll wrap up with this one. What or who inspires you to do the work that you're doing?
Ooh, I don't know. That's a tough question. I mean, I think that I'm inspired by, on the one hand, I'm inspired by the issues that I feature. Activists tend to inspire me, and that's why I feature them quite a bit in my videos. Movements inspire me, obviously. That sounds almost tautological to say, but it's true. And then on the other hand, there's the art, the storytelling, and the journalism. I have my list of favorite journalists. Adrian Chen, I would say, is probably my very favorite right now. A terrific storyteller. And then there's video producer. This sounds like a cheap plug for my employer, but that movie Spotlight was some of the best storytelling I think I've ever seen done on film. I'm inspired by activists and social movements, and then I'm inspired by incredible storytellers, and I have my list of favorites, but that it all comes down to taste. That's just my personal preferences.
Excellent. Well, we're gonna have to see Spotlight for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Terrific movie.
Well, thank you. You've been a great guest. I love your insight, love your short films, and your writing. I'm going to get back to reading more of your print media stuff. So,
Thank you, Leighton, for spending time with us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me. And by the way, for my URL, my first name is hard to guess how to spell. It's Leighton Woodhouse.com. That's my website. So thank you very much.
Okay, I was just about to mention that, but I wasn't going to spell it because, we have the most intelligent audience in the world.
That's what we tell ourselves. All right. Thank you, Layton.
Okay. Take care. Bye.
All right. It was Layton Woodhouse, journalist, filmmaker, graphic designer from Los Angeles. And again, LeightonWoodhouse.com, LEIGHTON, Woodhouse.com. Guy, you got a climate update?
Yes, I do. And feel free to chime in with any clever remarks along the way because I'm running out of clever things to say.
I will try and do that.
Shut up. And by running out, I mean I ran out of clever things to say about 10 years ago. Okay. Field researchers are finally beginning to provide local examples in support of the finding from the August 2013 issue of Ecology Letters that the rate of evolution trails the rate of climate change by a factor of 10,000. An example comes from the January 20th, 2016 online issue of Global Ecology and Biogeography, focused on California, which has an extensive collection of herbarium records. Herbarium records are plant collections, collected plants that are put on a piece of cardboard, basically, and described in terms of their location and other plants around them. The researchers used 681,609 geo-referenced herbarium records to estimate mean shifts in elevational and climatic space of 4,426 plant taxa, taxa meaning generally species level, and found that non-native invasive species were more likely to be expanding their ranges than native species. Furthermore, plants and animals did not move together in synchronized fashion, thereby leading to the suspicion that ecological communities are breaking down and disassembling. I'd say the suspicion is pretty well documented at this point, but it's yet another example of the conservative nature of the Referee Journal literature. Over the past 10 years, the Atlantic Ocean has soaked up 50% more carbon dioxide than it did the decade before. 50% more in one decade compared to the decade before, measurably speeding up the acidification of the ocean, according to a paper published in the January 30th, 2016 issue of Global Biogeochemical Cycles. I've added this information to feedback number 23.
Pacific Ocean, Indian Ocean, don't get any love here?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, we ignore those babies. According to a paper in the February 1st, 2016 issue of Nature Geoscience, ponds less than a quarter of an acre in size make up only 8.6% of the surface area of the world's lakes and ponds, yet they account for 15.1% of carbon dioxide emissions and 40.6% of diffusive methane emissions. That's absolutely huge. Mm-hmm. I've added this information to feedback number 28, which addresses methane emissions from small water bodies. I mean, think about that for a minute. Less than 9% of the surface area of the world's lakes and ponds and 40%.
What's the explanation for that? Is there?
There isn't one.
Oh.
This is sort of the early days of research. You document the pattern that is occurring, then you start digging around trying to figure out WTF.
So right now it's, oh.
Yeah.
Huh.
Exactly.
But, uh-oh.
Right. It's one stage from, I don't know, to, oh. That's where I spend most of my time. A paper in the February 3rd, 2016 issue of Nature finds a long-sought smoking gun with respect to carbon storage in the deep ocean. As it turns out, carbon was stored in the depths of the Southern Ocean when atmospheric carbon dioxide levels were quite low. It was hiding there, which explains why CO2 levels in the atmosphere were so low in Earth's past. This has been one of the arguments used by climate change deniers. Look, carbon dioxide levels in the past have been low, they've been high, we don't know anything. But in fact, that carbon was hiding in the Southern Ocean, trapped there as a result of decomposition of plants and animals, and then sinking to the bottom of the ocean, having a bunch of carbon there.
Very clever.
So this is a big deal. It's a nice place to hide.
Right.
You might look into that.
Thanks.
Afforestation and forest management, otherwise known as planting and tending trees, are considered to be key instruments in mitigating climate change. You know, it's funny. I used to write that way, and I can't imagine anybody could actually read it or would want to. Come on. Why don't we just call it planting and tending trees? Mm-hmm. Yes, those are considered to be key instruments in mitigating climate change. Mm-hmm. But as indicated by a paper in the February 5th, 2016 issue of Science, the expansion of Europe's forests toward dark green conifers has stoked global warming. Mm-hmm. The darkly colored evergreen trees have been planted for their ability to grow quickly with relatively little management, because we're all about convenience in this culture. But their propensity to sequester atmospheric carbon dioxide has been outstripped by their dark color.
So we can't even plant the right fucking trees.
Exactly.
We fucked that up too.
Thus, according to the abstract of the paper, quote, 2.5 centuries of forest management in Europe have not cooled the climate.
Oops.
2.5 centuries.
Yeah, that's just, that's something to look back. That's just disappointing.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure we can fix this.
Right.
I mean, we're white guys in the global north.
We can fix it. Sure. Well, we do know anything.
But for the last 250 years, there have been white guys in the global north there in Europe. And they...
Yeah, but I'm going to write an article on this.
I look forward to that.
Yeah, there'll be some comments.
A paper in the February 8th, 2016 online issue of Nature Climate Change reinforces prior findings about the collapse of major ice shelves in Antarctica. Some of these country-sized so-called safety bands are extremely dynamic and therefore susceptible to rapid breakup.
Country-sized?
The size of countries.
Yeah. Not just Lithuania.
No, real countries.
Okay. Oops. Real countries. Now, we're not insulting any Lithuanians out there, by the way.
Not on purpose, because right. We don't need to try.
Right.
I've added this tidbit to feedback number 7. The proportion of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere now exceeds 405 parts per million, according to direct measurements at Mauna Loa. That's the highest level in 15 million years.
405.org.
You know, but if we...
We should get that URL right now.
And if we add on just one other atmospheric gas, yeah. Methane, which is currently at about 2,000 parts per billion or 2 parts per million... Using the U.S. system of millions and billions.
Not a catchy URL.
Yeah, I know. But that adds at least 100 times. It's 100 times more powerful than carbon dioxide is. So we're at least 600 parts per million equivalent of carbon dioxide.
And that, folks, is a lot.
Yes, that's a big number. Yeah. So I think we should skip 405.org and go to 600.org.
Okay. Well, we can get both.
We can fix this.
Because we can profit off that.
In any event, 405 parts per million, that's the highest level in 15 million years, and the greatest increase from the year before in measurement history.
Wow.
And it's only February. Atmospheric carbon dioxide typically reaches its annual peak about 3 months from now.
Mm.
Uh-oh. This could get serious. I'm just saying. Another paper in the same journal, the February 8th, 2016 online issue of Nature Climate Change, points out the long-term impacts of ongoing changes in Earth's climate. I'll quote from the abstract. Quote, here we argue that the 20th and 21st centuries need to be placed into a long-term context that includes the next 10 millennia over which the projected impacts of anthropogenic climate change will grow and persist. This long-term perspective illustrates that policy decisions made in the next few years to decades will have profound impacts on global climate ecosystems and human societies, not just for this century, but for the next 10 millennia and beyond, end quote.
How long do you think we're going to be around?
Well, bazinga. Exactly. So it's it's something that we need to fix within the next few years.
Wow. This is from Nature Climate Change.
This is from Nature Climate Change. And
not man-made climate change.
Obviously, I'm no fan of politics as any sort of solution, as we've long known civilization itself is a heat engine. But I'm pleased that the authors of this latter paper are finally coming to grips with long-term processes.
The next 10 millennia.
Yeah.
And beyond.
You know, and we've known since February 2009, when there was a paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, indicating that the temperature associated with the current level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is locked in for at least the next 1,000 years.
Okay.
At least the next 1,000 years. So at the time, that was 385 parts per million carbon dioxide. What that means is, based on historical records,
right.
on real events, not models, what that means is we were locked into 385 parts per million. The temperature associated with that is 6 degrees Celsius above baseline for at least the next 1,000 years. So 350.org actually started their first movement in the fall of that year, 9 months after anybody paying attention knew that it wouldn't matter.
Right.
It's almost as if they were funded by the Rockefellers to, you know, make money.
Yeah, and don't bring up the baked-in part.
But we can bring up bacon.
Right.
Which is a whole different thing.
Bacon. God's bookmark.
And there goes our vegan audience.
The dessert of meats.
Didn't I tell you to shut up a while ago?
Sorry. Do we have any more things to talk about? Because we have some time, don't we?
Yeah, we have a few minutes.
Who do we got coming up for guests?
We have next week somebody I'm very excited about. We have Doug Peacock, who played who is the inspiration for Ed Abbey's main character in his most important work of fiction, The Monkey Wrench Gang.
Oh, wow.
And The Monkey Wrench Gang featured this protagonist named George Washington Hayduke. And he was based on Doug Peacock, who was Ed Abbey's friend. So Doug Peacock comes back from Vietnam, and he's kind of got PTSD, although nobody knew what to call it then. And as you might expect, some of his relationships fell apart. He ended up moving to Montana. He wrote a book called Grizzly Years. He spent a lot of time out there with the grizzlies because he could associate and identify better with the wild animals than he could with the people. I get that.
Yeah, we're almost there.
Exactly.
Sort of. No offense to anybody in the room.
And the book, Grizzly Years, which I would recommend to anybody, it starts reading like fiction. Like, I can't believe he's putting these words on paper and expecting us to believe it.
Oh. So it's gripping.
Unbelievably so. And the first two chapters, I remember thinking,
this is bullshit.
He's making this up.
Yeah.
This can't possibly be real. And then you read on and you realize he was out there with those grizzlies.
Wow.
And coming face to face with them and trying to understand their behavior. And whoa. And it was real.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Well, and, you know, the guy that I think there's a documentary, the grizzly man guy, some people don't live through that. Actually, most people don't live
right.
through that.
Exactly. So. And we'll have to ask Doug Peacock next week if that was his intent, whether he intended to live through it or not.
Yeah, that's a good question, right.
Because, you know, he came back with PTSD and his relationship fell apart. And
the odds of living through something like that are probably pretty small.
Right, so maybe he was pushing the envelope trying not to live.
Right. Who else? What else we got? Well, we got a call out show eventually down the road of Bill McFibbin.
Yes, although we try to be professional about it. Use his actual name.
You're the professional here. I'm just the canned laughter.
We have what looks like is going to be for us a clip show coming up in 2 weeks.
So that's between Peacock and the McGibbon.
Right.
Call out.
Right. And then on March 8th, it looks like we're going to have
Marty.
I know your name, Marty. I've got it here somewhere. No, really, I do. And Marty has written a couple of books about climate change that I haven't read, but that look gripping. Marty Essen has written a book going back to 2007, I think was his first book about climate change. And then more recently, he's written another book that just came out.
Okay.
And so we'll talk about his latest book, which just came out apparently within the last few months. And he goes around and speaks on college campuses prolifically.
That's a rarity to talk about climate change in college campuses.
Yes. I'm guessing he doesn't go quite as far as I do.
No, probably not.
Speaking about climate change.
Right.
But interestingly, his...
Which is why he's got gigs.
Right. His email message to me starts with the subject line, "Some say humans can adapt to global warming, but what about the animals?"
Mm.
And since we are animals,
right,
we might have a tough time adjusting to climate change if the other animals can't.
You and I aren't animals. We're domesticated, indoctrinated... incarcerated on our way to being liberated.
Right.
White men.
Otherwise known as animals.
Animals.
Say it with me.
Animal. So that is, so we have February 16th, Peacock. February 23rd, we're doing a clip show.
You and me on our own. I don't know what we're going to talk about.
Send us
your ideas.
Take suggestions.
Yes.
Then March 1st, the McKibben call-out show. And
then March 8th, we have Marty Essence. Uh-huh. And that's all we have planned so far. I want to tell just a short story. We're almost out of time here. I want to tell a short story about Doug Peacock. I met him at a book signing many, many, many years ago in Tucson. And I doubt he remembers that, and I barely remember it myself. And it was for his book, Grizzly Years.
Okay.
And then years later, I have this student who I'm advising. at the University of Arizona. And this guy comes in, he's an honors student, and he wants to do this project through the Honors College, and he needs me to write a letter or something in support of him. And his name is Colin Peacock. And he's talking to me, and this project is to determine if there is a corridor for large carnivores between Yellowstone and the Wind River Range in Wyoming. And he starts, and so I ask him, do you know anybody who actually knows anything about grizzly bears? And he lists all the relevant people at Yellowstone. There's two brothers who've been studying bears there for a long time. And then he says, and of course, there's my dad. And that's when it hit me. You're Doug Peacock's kid. And I was jumping up and down. I was excited as a school child, because here I was in the room with Doug Peacock's kid, Colin.
I was
so excited.
You weren't a professional at that point.
Right, and I never have been. I see it on the internet all the time.
All right. Well, that about wraps it up for this week. Make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last, and the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. Feel free to post questions you'd like to address in the show and share our link as many places as you possibly can. Please continue to follow Guy's blog at GuyMcPherson.com for further essays, updates, and speaking tours. And we'll see you on the radio next Tuesday afternoon at 3 p.m. Eastern. We'll be interviewing, as we talked about, author Doug Peacock, the inspiration for the lead character in Edward Abbey's book, The Monkey Wrench Gang. If you missed the show, make sure to find us in the archives at PRN.FM or at Stitcher.com and rate us on iTunes. Thanks again to Leighton Woodhouse for joining us and for his work, and also Afrozen, as always, for his music. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end...
Nature bats last.
Da 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 da.
Mother Nature.